After that, nothing else remained to do, except to resume striding back and forth along the bare track that stretched from a boulder to where he slept. He was still pacing when footsteps sounded in the forest below. Grabbing his bow, Roran hid and waited. Relief rushed through him when Baldur's face bobbed into view. Roran waved him over. As they sat, Roran said, "Why hasn't anyone come?" "We couldn't," said Baldur, wiping sweat off his brow. "The soldiers have been watching us too closely. This was the first opportunity we had to get away. I can't stay long either." He turned his face toward the peak above them and shuddered. "You're braver than I, staying here. Have you had any trouble with wolves, bears, mountain cats?" "No, no, I'm fine. Did the soldiers say anything new?" "One of them bragged to Morn last night that their squad was hand-picked for this mission." Roran frowned. "They haven't been too quiet. At least two or three of them get drunk each night. A group of them tore up Morn's common room the first day. Did they pay for the damage?" "Course not." Roran shifted, staring down at the village. "I still have trouble believing that the Empire would go to these lengths to capture me. What could I give them? What do they think I can give them?" Baldur followed his gaze. "The Razak questioned Katrina today. Someone mentioned that the two of you are close, and the Razak were curious if she knew where you'd gone." Roran refocused on Baldur's open face. "Is she all right?"
"It would take more than those two to scare her," reassured Baldur.
His next sentence was cautious and probing. "Perhaps you should consider turning yourself in."
"I'd sooner hang myself and them with me."
Roran started up and stalked over his usual route, still tapping his leg.
"How can you say that, knowing how they tortured my father?"
Catching his arm, Baldur said, "What happens if you remain in hiding and the soldiers don't give up and leave? They'll assume we lied to help you escape. The Empire doesn't forgive traitors." Roran shrugged off Baldur. He spun around, tapping his leg, then abruptly sat.
"If I don't show myself, the Razak will blame the people at hand. If I attempt to lead the Razak away..."
Roran was not a skilled enough woodsman to evade 30 men and the Razak.
"Aragorn could do it, but not me.
Still, unless the situation changed, it might be the only choice available to him." He looked at Baldur.
"I don't want anyone to be hurt on my behalf.
I'll wait for now, and if the Razak grow impatient and threaten someone, well then, I'll think of something else to do."
"It's a nasty situation all around," offered Baldur.
"One I intend to survive." Baldur departed soon afterward, leaving Roran alone with his thoughts on his endless path. He covered mile after mile, grinding a rut into the earth under the weight of his ruminations. When chill dusk arrived, he removed his boots, for fear of wearing them out, and proceeded to pad barefoot. Just as the waxing moon rose and subsumed the night shadows in beams of marble light, Roran noticed a disturbance in Carvajal. Scores of lanterns bobbed through the darkened village, winking in and out as they floated behind houses. The yellow specks clustered in the centre of Carvajal, like a cloud of fireflies, then streamed haphazardly toward the edge of town, where they were met by a hard line of torches from the soldiers' camp. For 2 hours, Roran watched the opposing sides face each other, the agitated lanterns milling helplessly against the stolid torches. Finally, the lambent groups dispersed and filtered back into the tents and houses. When nothing else of interest occurred, Roran untied his bedroll and slipped under the blankets. Throughout the next day, Carvajal was consumed with unusual activity. Figures strode between houses, and even, Roran was surprised to see, rode out into Palancar Valley toward various farms. At noon, he saw two men enter the soldiers' camp and disappear into the Razak's tent for almost an hour. So involved was he with the proceedings, Roran barely moved the entire day. He was in the middle of dinner when, as he had hoped, Baldur reappeared.
"Hungry?"
asked Roran, gesturing. Baldur shook his head and sat with an air of exhaustion. Dark lines under his eyes made his skin look thin and bruised. "Quimby's dead."
Roran's bowl clattered as it struck the ground. He cursed, wiping cold stew off his leg, then asked,
"How?"
"A couple of soldiers started bothering Tara last night." Tara was Morn's wife. "She didn't really mind, except the men got in a fight over who she was supposed to serve next. Quimby was there, checking a cask Morn said had turned, and he tried to break them up." Roran nodded. "That was Quimby, always interfering to make sure others behaved properly. Only thing is, a soldier threw a pitcher and hit him on the temple. Killed him instantly." Roran stared at the ground with his hands on his hips, struggling to regain control over his ragged breathing. He felt as if Baldur had knocked the wind out of him.
"It doesn't seem possible. Quimby gone?"
"The farmer and part-time brewer was as much a part of the landscape as the mountains surrounding Carvajal, an unquestioned presence that shaped the fabric of the village."
"Will the men be punished?"
Baldur held up his hand. "Right after Quimby died, the Razak stole his body from the tavern and hauled it out to their tents. We tried to get it back last night, but they wouldn't talk with us."
"I saw."
Baldur grunted, rubbing his face. "Dad and Loring met with the Razak today and managed to convince them to release the body. The soldiers, however, won't face any consequences." He paused. "I was about to leave when Quimby was handed over. You know what his wife got? Bones."
"Bones?"
"Every one of them was nibbled clean. You could see the bite marks, and most had been cracked open for the marrow." Disgust gripped Roran, as well as profound horror for Quimby's fate. It was well known that a person's spirit could never rest until his body was given a proper burial. Revolted by the desecration, he asked,
"What? Who ate him, then?"
The soldiers were just as appalled. It must have been the Razak.
"Why? To what end?"
"I don't think," said Baldur, "that the Razak are human. You've never seen them up close, but their breath is foul, and they always cover their faces with black scarves. Their backs are humped and twisted, and they speak to each other with clicks. Even their men seem to fear them."
"If they aren't human, then what kind of creatures can they be?"
demanded Roran.
"They're not Urgles."
"Who knows?" Fear now joined Roran's revulsion, fear of the supernatural. He saw it echoed on Baldur's face as the young man clasped his hands. For all the stories of Galbatorix's misdeeds, it was still a shock to have the king's evil roosted among their homes. A sense of history settled on Roran, as he realized he was involved with forces he had previously been acquainted with only through songs and stories.
"Something should be done," he muttered.
The air grew warmer through the night, until by afternoon Palancar Valley shimmered and sweltered with the unexpected spring heat. Carvajal looked peaceful under the bald blue sky, yet Roran could feel the sour resentment that clenched its inhabitants with malicious intensity. The calm was like a sheet stretched taut in the wind. Despite the aura of expectation, the day proved to be utterly boring. Roran spent most of his time brushing Horst's mare. At last he lay to sleep, looking up past the towering pines at the haze of stars that adorned the night sky. They seemed so close it felt as if he hurtled among them, falling toward the blackest void. The moon was setting when Roran woke, his throat raw from smoke. He coughed and rolled upright, blinking as his eyes burned and watered. The noxious fumes made it difficult to breathe. Roran grabbed his blankets and saddled the frightened mare, then spurred her further up the mountain, hoping to find clear air. It quickly became apparent that the smoke was ascending with him, so he turned and cut sideways through the forest. After several minutes spent manoeuvring in the dark, they finally broke free and rode onto a ledge, swept clean by a breeze. Purging his lungs with long breaths, Roran scanned the valley for the fire. He spotted it in an instant. Carvajal's hay barn glowed white in a cyclone of flames, transforming its precious contents into a fountain of amber motes. Roran trembled as he watched the destruction of the town's feed. He wanted to scream and run through the forest to help with the bucket brigade, yet he could not force himself to abandon his own safety. Now a molten spark landed on Delwyn's house. Within seconds, the thatched roof exploded in a wave of fire. Roran cursed and tore his hair, tears streaming down his face. This was why mishandling fire was a hanging offence in Carvajal. Was it an accident? Was it the soldiers? Are the Razak punishing the villagers for shielding me? Am I somehow responsible for this? Fisk's house joined the conflagration next. Aghast, Roran could only avert his face, hating himself for his cowardice. By dawn, all the fires had been extinguished or burned out on their own. Only sheer luck and a calm night saved the rest of Carvajal from being consumed. Roran waited until he was sure of the outcome, then retreated to his old camp and threw himself down to rest. From morning through evening he was oblivious to the world, except through the lens of his troubled dreams. Upon his return to awareness, Roran simply waited for the visitor he was sure would appear. This time, it was Ulbreich. He arrived at dusk with a grim, worn expression. "Come with me," he said. Roran tensed. Why? Have they decided to give me up? If he was the cause of the fire, he could understand the villagers wanting him gone. He might even agree it was necessary. It was unreasonable to expect everyone in Carvajal to sacrifice themselves for him. Still, that did not mean he would allow them to just hand him over to the Razak. After what the two monsters had done to Quimby, Roran would fight to the death to avoid being their prisoner. "Because," said Ulbreich, clenching his jaw muscles, "it was the soldiers who started the fire. Morn banned them from the Seven Sheaves, but they still got drunk on their own beer. One of them dropped a torch against the hay barn on his way to bed." "Was anyone hurt?" asked Roran. "A few burns. Gertrude was able to handle them. We tried to negotiate with the Razak. They spat at our request that the Empire replace our losses and the guilty face justice. They even refused to confine the soldiers to the tents." "So why should I return?" Ulbreich chuckled hollowly. "For hammer and tongs. We need your help to remove the Razak." "You would do that for me?" "We're not risking ourselves for your sake alone. This concerns the entire village now. At least come talk to Father and the others and hear their thoughts. I think you would be glad to get out of these cursed mountains." Roran considered Ulbreich's proposition long and hard before deciding to accompany him. "It's this or run for it. And I can always run later." He fetched the mare, tied his bags to the saddle, then followed Ulbreich toward the valley floor. Their progress slowed as they neared Carvajal, using trees and brush for cover. Slipping behind a rain barrel, Ulbreich checked to see if the streets were clear, then signalled to Roran. Together they crept from shadow to shade, constantly on guard for the Empire's servants. At Horst's forge, Ulbreich opened one of the double doors just far enough for Roran and the mayor to quietly enter. Inside, the workshop was lit by a single candle, which cast a trembling glow over the ring of faces that hovered about it in the surrounding darkness. Horst was there, his thick beard protruding like a shelf into the light, flanked by the hard visages of Delwyn, Gedrick, and then Loring. The rest of the group was composed of younger men: Baldur, Loring's three sons, Parr, and Quimby's boy, Nolfavrel, who was only 13. They all turned to look as Roran entered the assembly. Horst said,
"Ah, you made it. You escaped misfortune while in the spine?"
"I was lucky."
"Then we can proceed."
"With what, exactly?"
Roran hitched the mare to an anvil as he spoke.
Loring answered, the shoemaker's parchment face a mass of contorting lines and grooves.
"We have attempted reason with these Razak, these invaders."
He stopped, his thin frame racked with an unpleasant metallic wheeze deep inside his chest.
"They have refused reason. They have endangered us all with no sign of remorse or contrition."
He made a noise in his throat, then said with pronounced deliberation,
"They must go. Such creatures!
No, said Roran. Not creatures, desecrators. The faces scowled and bobbed in agreement. Delwyn picked up the thread of conversation.
The point is, everyone's life is at stake. If that fire had spread any farther, dozens of people would have been killed, and those who escaped would have lost everything they own. As a result, we've agreed to drive the Razak away from Carvajal. Will you join us?
Roran hesitated.
What if they return, or send for reinforcements? We can't defeat the entire Empire.
No, said Horst, grave and solemn. But neither can we stand silent and allow the soldiers to kill us and to destroy our property. A man can endure only so much abuse before he must strike back.
Loring laughed, throwing back his head so the flame gilded the stumps of his teeth.
First we fortify, he whispered with glee. Then we fight. We'll make them regret they ever clapped their festering eyes on Carvajal.
Retaliation. After Roran agreed to their plan, Horst began distributing shovels, pitchforks, flails, anything that could be used to beat the soldiers and the Razak away. Roran hefted a pick, then set it aside. Though he had never cared for Brom's stories, one of them, the Song of Gerund, resonated with him whenever he heard it. It told of Gerund, the greatest warrior of his time, who relinquished his sword for a wife and farm. He found no peace, however, as a jealous lord initiated a blood feud against Gerund's family, which forced Gerund to kill once more. Yet he did not fight with his blade, but with a simple hammer. Going to the wall, Roran removed a medium-sized hammer with a long handle and a rounded blade on one side of the head. He tossed it from hand to hand, then went to Horst and asked, "May I have this?" Horst eyed the tool and Roran.
"Use it wisely." Then he said to the rest of the group, "Listen, we want to scare, not kill. Break a few bones if you want, but don't get carried away. And whatever you do, don't stand and fight. No matter how brave or heroic you feel, remember that they are trained soldiers."
When everyone was equipped, they left the forge and wound their way through Carvajal to the edge of the Razak's camp. The soldiers had already gone to bed, except for four sentries who patrolled the perimeter of the grey tents. The Razak's two horses were picketed by a smouldering fire. Horst quietly issued orders, sending Olbrych and Delwyn to ambush two of the sentries and Parr and Roran to ambush the other two. Roran held his breath as he stalked the oblivious soldier. His heart began to shudder as energy spiked through his limbs. He hid behind the corner of a house, quivering, and waited for Horst's signal.
Wait! Wait!
With a roar, Horst burst from hiding, leading the charge into the tents. Roran darted forward and swung his hammer, catching the sentry on the shoulder with a grisly crunch. The man howled and dropped his halberd. He staggered as Roran struck his ribs and back. Roran raised the hammer again and the man retreated, screaming for help. Roran ran after him, shouting incoherently. He knocked in the side of a wool tent, trampling whatever was inside, then smashed the top of a helmet he saw emerging from another tent. The metal rang like a bell. Roran barely noticed as Loring danced past. The old man cackled and hooted in the night as he jabbed the soldiers with a pitchfork. Everywhere was a confusion of struggling bodies. Whirling around, Roran saw a soldier attempting to string his bow. He rushed forward and hit the back of the bow with his steel mallet, breaking the wood in two. The soldier fled. The Razak scrambled free of their tent with terrible screeches, swords in hand. Before they could attack, Baldur untethered the horses and sent them galloping toward the two scarecrow figures. The Razak separated, then regrouped, only to be swept away as the soldiers' morale broke and they ran. Then it was over. Roran panted in the silence, his hand cramped around the hammer's handle. After a moment, he picked his way through the crumpled mounds of tents and blankets to Horst. The smith was grinning under his beard.
"That's the best brawl I've had in years."
Behind them, Carvajal jumped to life as people tried to discover the source of the commotion. Roran watched flames flare up behind shuttered windows, then turned as he heard soft sobbing. The boy, Nolfavrel, was kneeling by the body of a soldier, methodically stabbing him in the chest as tears slid down his chin. Gedrick and Oldbrike hurried over and pulled Nolfavrel away from the corpse.
"He shouldn't have come," said Roran.
Horst shrugged.
"It was his right."
"All the same, killing one of the Razak's men will only make it harder to rid ourselves of the desecrators. We should barricade the road and between the houses, so they won't catch us by surprise."
Studying the men for any injuries, Roran saw that Delwyn had received a long cut on his forearm, which the farmer bandaged with a strip torn from his ruined shirt. With a few shouts, Horst organized their group. He dispatched Olbrike and Baldur to retrieve Quimby's wagon from the forge, and had Loring's sons and Pa scour Carverhall for items that could be used to secure the village. Even as he spoke, people congregated on the edge of the field, staring at what was left of the Razak's camp and the dead soldier.
"What happened?" cried Fisk.
Loring scuttled forward and stared the carpenter in the eye.
"What happened? I'll tell you what happened. We routed the dung beardlings, caught them with their boots off and whipped them like dogs."
"I am glad." The strong voice came from Birgit, an auburn-haired woman who clasped Nolfavrel against her bosom, ignoring the blood smeared across his face.
"They deserve to die like cowards for my husband's death."
The villagers murmured in agreement. But then Thane spoke.
"Have you gone mad, Horst? Even if you frightened off the Razak and their soldiers, Galbatorix will just send more men. The Empire will never give up until they get Roran."
"We should hand him over," snarled Sloane.
Horst raised his hands.
"I agree. No one is worth more than all of Carverhall. But if we surrender Roran, do you really think Galbatorix will let us escape punishment for our resistance? In his eyes, we're no better than the Varden."
"Then why did you attack?" demanded Thane. "Who gave you the authority to make this decision? You've doomed us all."
This time, Birgit answered.
"Would you let them kill your wife?"
She pressed her hands on either side of her son's face, then showed Thane her bloody palms like an accusation.
"Would you let them burn us? Where is your manhood, Loanbreaker?"
He lowered his gaze, unable to face her stark expression.
"They burned my farm," said Roran,
"devoured Quimby and nearly destroyed Carverhall. Such crimes cannot go unpunished. Are we frightened rabbits to cower down and accept our fate? No, we have a right to defend ourselves."
He stopped as Olbrike and Baldur trudged up the street, dragging the wagon.
"We can debate later. Now we have to prepare. Who will help us?"
40 or more men volunteered. Together they set about the difficult task of making Carverhall impenetrable. Roran worked incessantly, nailing fence slats between houses, piling barrels full of rocks for makeshift walls, and dragging logs across the main road, which they blocked with two wagons tipped on their sides. As Roran hurried from one chore to another, Katrina waylaid him in an alley. She hugged him, then said,
"I'm glad you're back, and that you're safe."
He kissed her lightly.
"Katrina, I have to speak with you as soon as we're finished."
She smiled uncertainly, but with a spark of hope.
"You were right. It was foolish of me to delay. Every moment we spend together is precious, and I have no desire to squander what time we have when a whim of fate could tear us apart."
Roran was tossing water on the thatching of Kizelt's house, so it could not catch fire, when Pa shouted,
"Razak!"
Dropping the bucket, Roran ran to the wagons where he had left his hammer. As he grabbed the weapon, he saw a single Razak sitting on a horse far down the road, almost out of bowshot. The creature was illuminated by a torch in its left hand, while its right was drawn back as if to throw something.
Roran laughed.
"Is he going to toss rocks at us? He's too far away to even hit."
He was cut off as the Razak whipped down its arm, and a glass vial arced across the distance between them and shattered against the wagon to his right. An instant later, a fireball launched the wagon into the air, while a fist of burning air flung Roran against a wall. Dazed, he fell to his hands and knees, gasping for breath. Through the roaring in his ears came the tattoo of galloping horses. He forced himself upright and faced the sound, only to dive aside as the Razak raced into Carvajal through the burning gap in the wagons.
The Razak reined in their steeds, blades flashing as they hacked at the people strewn around them.
Roran saw three men die, then Horst and Loring reached the Razak and began pressing them back with pitchforks. Before the villagers could rally, soldiers poured through the breach, killing indiscriminately in the darkness. Roran knew they had to be stopped, else Carvajal would be taken. He jumped at a soldier, catching him by surprise, and hit him in the face with the hammer's blade. The soldier crumpled without a sound. As the man's compatriots rushed toward him, Roran wrestled the corpse's shield off his limp arm. He barely managed to get it free in time to block the first strike.
Backstepping toward the Razak, Roran parried a sword thrust, then swung his hammer up under the man's chin, sending him to the ground.
"To me!" shouted Roran. "Defend your homes!" He sidestepped a jab as five men attempted to encircle him. "To me!" Baldur answered his call first, then Olbrich. A few seconds later, Loring's sons joined him, followed by a score of others. From the side streets, women and children pelted the soldiers with rocks. "Stay together," ordered Roran, standing his ground. "There are more of us." The soldiers halted as the line of villagers before them continued to thicken. With more than 100 men at his back, Roran slowly advanced.
"Attack, you fools!"
screamed a Razak, dodging Loring's pitchfork. A single arrow whizzed toward Roran. He caught it on his shield and laughed. The Razak were level with the soldiers now, hissing with frustration. They glared at the villagers from under their inky cowls. Suddenly, Roran felt himself become lethargic and powerless to move. It was hard to even think. Fatigue seemed to chain his arms and legs in place. Then from farther in Carvajal, Roran heard a raw shout from Birgit. A second later, a rock hurtled over his head and bore toward the lead Razak, who twitched with supernatural speed to avoid the missile. The distraction, slight though it was, freed Roran's mind from the soporific influence. Was that magic? He wondered.
He dropped the shield, grasped his hammer with both hands, and raised it far above his head, just like Horst did when spreading metal.
Roran went up on tiptoe, his entire body bowed backward, then whipped his arms down with a ha! The hammer cartwheeled through the air and bounced off the Razak's shield, leaving a formidable dent. The two attacks were enough to disrupt the last of the Razak's strange power. They clicked rapidly to each other as the villagers roared and marched forward. Then the Razak yanked on their reins, wheeling around.
"Retreat!"
they growled, riding past the soldiers.
The crimson-clad warriors sullenly backed out of Carvajal,
stabbing at anyone who came too close. Only when they were a good distance from the burning wagons did they dare turn their backs. Roran sighed and retrieved his hammer, feeling the bruises on his side and back where he had hit the wall. He bowed his head as he saw that the explosion had killed Parr. 9 other men had died. Already wives and mothers rent the night with their wails of grief.
"How could this happen here?"
"Everyone, come!" called Baldur. Roran blinked and stumbled to the middle of the road where Baldur stood. A Razak sat beetle-like on a horse only 20 yards away. The creature crooked a finger at Roran and said,
You smell like your cousin. We never forget a smell."
"What do you want?" he shouted. "Why are you here?" The Razak chuckled in a horrible, insectile way.
"We want information."
It glanced over its shoulder where its companions had disappeared, then cried,
"Release Roran, and you shall be sold as slaves. Protect him, and we will eat you all. We shall have your answer when next we come. Be sure it is the right one."
as Shweldon Rak Anuin. Light burst into the tunnel as the doors dragged open. Eragon winced, his eyes sorely unaccustomed to daylight after so long underground.
Beside him, Saphira hissed and arched her neck to get a better view of their surroundings.
It had taken them 2 days to traverse the subterranean passage from Farthendur, though it felt longer to Eragon due to the never-ending dusk that surrounded them and the silence it had imposed upon their group.
In all, he could recall only a handful of words being exchanged during their journey.
Eragon had hoped to learn more about Arya while they travelled together, but the only information he had gleaned came simply as a result of observation. He had not supped with her before, and was startled to see that she brought her own food and ate no meat. When he asked her why, she said,
"You will never again consume an animal's flesh after you have been trained, or if you do, it will be only on the rarest of occasions."
"Why should I give up meat?" he scoffed.
"I cannot explain with words, but you will understand once we reach Ellesmira."
All that was forgotten now as he hurried to the door's threshold, eager to see their destination.
He found himself standing on a granite outcropping, more than 100 feet above a purple-hued lake, brilliant under the eastern sun.
Like Costa Myrna, the water reached from mountain to mountain, filling the valley's end.
From the lake's far side, the Arj Ragni flowed north, winding between the peaks until, in the far distance, it rushed out onto the eastern plains.
To his right, the mountains were bare, save for a few trails, but to his left was the dwarf city, Tarnag. Here, the dwarves had reworked the seemingly immutable Beors into a series of terraces. The lower terraces were mainly farms, dark curves of land waiting to be planted, dotted with squat halls, which, as best he could tell, were built entirely of stone. Above those empty levels rose tier upon tier of interlocking buildings until they culminated in a giant dome of gold and white. It was as if the entire city was nothing more than a line of steps leading to the dome. The cupola glistened like polished moonstone, a milky bead floating atop a pyramid of grey slate.
Oryk anticipated Aragorn's question, saying,
"That is Selbadil, the greatest temple of dwarfdom and home of Dordrimst Quan, the Quan clan, who act as servants and messengers to the gods."
"Do they rule Tarnag?"
asked Saphira.
Aragorn repeated the query.
"Nay," said Arya, stepping past them. "Though the Quan are strong, they are small in numbers, despite their power over the afterlife, and gold. It is the Ragni Heftin, the river guard, who control Tarnag. We will stay with their clan chief, Undin, while here."
As they followed the elf off the outcropping and through the gnarled forest that blanketed the mountain,
Oryk whispered to Eragon,
"Mind her not. She has been arguing with the Quan for many a year. Every time she visits Tarnag and speaks with a priest, it produces a quarrel fierce enough to scare a cull."
"Arya?"
Oryk nodded grimly.
"I know little of it, but I've heard she disagrees strongly with much that the Quan practice. It seems that elves do not hold with muttering into the air for help."
Eragon stared at Arya's back as they descended, wondering if Oryk's words were true, and if so, what Arya herself believed. He took a deep breath, pushing the matter from his mind. It felt wonderful to be back in the open, where he could smell the moss and ferns and trees of the forest, where the sun was warm on his face, and bees and other insects swarmed pleasantly. The path took them down to the edge of the lake before rising back toward Tarnag and its open gates.
"How have you hidden Tarnag from Galbatorix?" asked Eragon.
"Farthendur, I understand, but this, I've never seen anything like it."
Oryk laughed softly.
"Hide it? That would be impossible. No, after the riders fell, we were forced to abandon all our cities above ground and retreat into our tunnels in order to escape Galbatorix and the Forsworn. They would often fly through the Beors, killing anyone who they encountered."
"I thought that dwarves always lived underground." Oryk's thick eyebrows met in a frown.
"Why should we? We may have an affinity for stone, but we like the open air as much as elves or humans. However, it has only been in the last decade and a half, ever since Morzan died, that we have dared return to Tarnag and other of our ancient dwellings. Galbatorax may be unnaturally powerful, but even he would not attack an entire city alone. Of course, he and his dragon could cause us no end of trouble if they wanted, but these days they rarely leave Urubane, even for short trips. Nor could Galbatorix bring an army here without first defeating Burag or Fardendur.
Which he nearly did, commented Saphira.
Cresting a small mound, Aragorn jolted with surprise as an animal crashed through the underbrush and onto the path.
The scraggly creature looked like a mountain goat from the spine, except that it was a third larger and had giant ribbed horns that curled around its cheeks, making an Urgal seem no bigger than a swallow nest.
Odder still was the saddle lashed across the goat's back, and the dwarf seated firmly on it, aiming a half-drawn bow into the air.
"Hart Dorgrimst, Fildrasten!" shouted the strange dwarf.
"Oric Thrifkes Menthiv un Hrethkrach Aragorn Rach Dorgrimst in Jitum,"
answered Oric.
"Won Asvanyali Karharug Arya! Neok Undens Grimspelarden."
The goat stared warily at Saphira. Aragorn noted how bright and intelligent its eyes were, though its face was rather droll, with its frosty beard and sombre expression. It reminded him of Hrothgar, and he almost laughed, thinking how very dwarfish the animal was.
"As Jokjordan Rust," came the reply.
With no discernible command on the dwarf's part, the goat leaped forward, covering such an extraordinary distance it seemed to take flight for a moment. Then rider and steed vanished between the trees.
"What was that?"
asked Aragorn, amazed. Oric resumed walking.
"A Feldunost, one of the five animals unique to these mountains. A clan is named after each one. However, Dorgrimst Feldunost is perhaps the bravest and most revered of the clans."
"Why so?"
"We depend upon Feldunost for milk, wool and meat. Without their sustenance we could not live in the Beors. When Galbatorix and his traitorous riders were terrorizing us, it was Dorgrimst Feldunost who risked themselves, and still do, to tend the herds and fields. As such, we are all in their debt."
"Do all dwarves ride Feldunost?" He stumbled slightly over the unusual word.
"Only in the mountains. Feldunost are hardy and sure-footed, but they are better suited for cliffs than open plains."
Saphira nudged Aragorn with her nose, causing Snowfire to shy away.
"Now those would be good hunting, better than any I had in the spine or hence. If I have time in Tarnag..."
"No," he said. "We can't afford to offend the dwarves." She snorted, irritated.
"I could ask permission first."
Now the path that had concealed them for so long under dark boughs entered the great clearing that surrounded Tarnag.
Groups of observers had already begun to gather in the fields when seven Feldunost with jewelled harnesses bounded out from the city. The riders bore lances tipped with pennants that snapped like whips in the air. Reining in his strange beast, the lead dwarf said,
"Thou art welcome to this city of Tarnag. By Otho of Undin and Ganel, I, Thorv, son of Brok, offer in peace the shelter of our halls."
His accent grumbled and rasped with a rough burr quite unlike Oric's.
"And by Hrothgar's Otho, we of the Injitum accept your hospitality," responded Oric.
"As do I, in Istlan Zadi's stead," added Arya. Appearing satisfied, Thorv motioned to his fellow riders, who spurred their Feldunos into formation around the four of them.
With a flourish, the dwarves rode off, guiding them to Tarnag and through the city gates.
The outer wall was 40 feet thick and formed a shadowed tunnel to the first of the many farms that belted Tarnag.
5 more tiers, each of which was defended by a fortified gate, carried them past the fields and into the city proper.
In contrast to Tarnag's thickly built ramparts, the buildings within, though of stone, were shaped with such cunning as to give the impression of grace and lightness.
Strong, bold carvings, usually of animals, adorned the houses and shops. But even more striking was the stone itself. Vibrant hues, from bright scarlet to the subtlest of greens, glazed the rock in translucent layers. And hung throughout the city were the dwarves' flameless lanterns, their multicoloured sparks harbingers of the Beor's long dusk and night. Unlike Trondheim, Tarnag had been constructed in proportion to the dwarves, with no concession for human, elf or dragon visitors. At the most, doorways were 5 feet high, and they were often only 4.5. Eragon was of middling height, but now he felt like a giant transported onto a puppet stage. The streets were wide and crammed. Dwarves of various clans hurried about their business or stood haggling in and around shops. Many were garbed in strange, exotic costumes, such as a block of fierce, black-haired dwarves who wore silver helmets forged in the likeness of wolf heads. Eragon stared at the dwarf women the most, as he had only caught brief glimpses of them while in Trondheim. They were broader than the men, and their faces were heavy-set, yet their eyes sparkled, and their hair was lustrous, and their hands were gentle on their diminutive children. They eschewed frippery, except for small, intricate brooches of iron and stone. At the Feldenost's piercing footsteps, the dwarves turned to look at the new arrivals. They did not cheer, as Eragon had expected, but rather bowed and murmured,
"Shade Slayer!"
As they saw the hammer and stars upon Eragon's helm, admiration was replaced by shock and, in many cases, outrage. A number of the angrier dwarves contracted around the Feldenost, glaring between the animals at Eragon and shouting imprecations. The back of Eragon's neck prickled. It seems that adopting me wasn't the most popular decision Hrothgar could make.
"Aye,"
agreed Saphira.
"He may have strengthened his hold on you, but at the cost of alienating many of the dwarves. We'd better get out of sight before blood is shed."
Thorv and the other guards rode forward as if the crowd was non-existent, clearing the way through 7 additional tiers, until only a single gate separated them from the mass of Selbadil. Then Thorv turned left, toward a great hall pressed against the side of the mountain and protected in 4 by a barbican with 2 machicolated towers. As they neared the hall, a group of armed dwarves streamed out from between the houses and formed a thick line, blocking the street. Long purple veils covered their faces and draped over their shoulders like mail coifs. The guards immediately reined in their Feldenost, faces hard.
"What is it?" Eragon asked Oric,
but the dwarf only shook his head and strode forward, a hand on his axe.
"Etzel Nitzketch!"
cried a veiled dwarf, raising a fist.
"Form Vhrethkarach! Form Jörgen Karmitar nos eta Goroth Bath Tarnag! Doren Sesti Rak Kithen! Jok is Warev Aj Barzulagor Dordor Greimst! Aj Schwelden Rak Anuen! Mog Torak Jörgen Vren! Ni Udem etal Ostras Norlag! Norlag Anna!"
For a long minute he continued to rant with growing spleen.
"Vran!"
barked Thorv, cutting him off. Then the 2 dwarves began arguing. Despite the harsh exchange, Eragon saw that Thorv seemed to respect the other dwarf. Eragon shifted to the side, trying to get a better view past Thorv's Feldenost, and the veiled dwarf abruptly fell silent, jabbing at Eragon's helm with an expression of horror.
"Nulag quana quaranu dorgrimstin jitum,"
he screamed.
"Quarzul ana Hrothgar un vulfield." "Jokis frick dor grimst vren?"
interrupted Oric quietly, drawing his axe. Worried, Eragon glanced at Arya, but she was too intent on the confrontation to notice him. He surreptitiously slid his hand down and around Zarok's wire-wrapped hilt. The strange dwarf stared hard at Oric, then removed an iron ring from his pocket, plucked 3 hairs from his beard, twined them around the ring, and threw it onto the street with an impervious clink, spitting after it. Without a word, the purple-shrouded dwarves filed away. Thorv, Oric and the other warriors flinched as the ring bounced across the granite pavement. Even Arya seemed taken aback. Two of the younger dwarves blanched and reached for their blades, then dropped their hands as Thorv barked,
"Etta!"
Their reactions unsettled Aragorn far more than the raucous exchange had. As Oric strode forward alone and deposited the ring in a pouch, Aragorn asked, "What does it mean?"
"It means," said Thorv, "that you have enemies."
They hurried through the barbican to a wide courtyard arrayed with three banquet tables, decorated with lanterns and banners.
Before the tables stood a group of dwarves, foremost among them a grey-bearded dwarf swathed in wolfskin. He spread his arms, saying,
"Welcome to Tarnag, home of Durgrim's Dragni Efthin. We have heard much praise of you, Aragorn Shadeslayer. I am Undin, son of Derund, the clan chief."
Another dwarf stepped forward. He had the shoulders and chest of a warrior, topped with hooded black eyes that never left Aragorn's face.
"And I, Ganel, son of Orm Bloodaxe, and clan chief of Durgrim's Dquan."
"It is an honour to be your guests," said Aragorn, inclining his head. He felt Saphira's irritation at being ignored.
"Patience," he murmured, forcing a smile. She snorted.
The clan chiefs greeted Arya and Oric in turn, but their hospitality was lost on Oric, whose only response was to extend his hand, the iron ring on his palm. Undin's eyes widened, and he gingerly lifted the ring, pinching it between his thumb and forefinger, as if it were a venomous snake.
"Who gave this to you?" "It was as Sweldon Rak Anwin, and not to me, but to Aragorn."
As alarm spread across their faces, Aragorn's earlier apprehension returned. He had seen lone dwarves face an entire group of Kull without shirking.
The ring must symbolize something dreadful indeed if it could undermine their courage.
Undin frowned as he listened to the muttering of his advisers, then said,
"We must consult on this issue. Shadeslayer, a feast is prepared in your honour. If you would allow my servants to guide you to your quarters, you can refresh yourself, and then we might begin."
"Of course." Aragorn handed Snowfire's reins to a waiting dwarf and followed a guide into the hall. As he passed through the doorway, he glanced back and saw Arya and Oric bustling away with the clan chiefs, their heads pressed close together.
"I won't be long," he promised Saphira.
After crouching through dwarf-sized corridors, he was relieved that the room assigned to him was spacious enough to stand freely. The servant bowed and said,
"I will return when Grimstboroth Undin is ready."
Once the dwarf was gone, Aragorn paused and took a deep breath, grateful for the silence.
The encounter with the veiled dwarves hovered in his mind, making it difficult for him to relax.
"At least we won't be in Tarnag long. That should prevent them from hindering us."
Peeling off his gloves, Aragorn went to a marble basin set on the floor next to the low bed. He put his hands in the water, then jerked them out with an involuntary yelp. The water was almost boiling.
"It must be a dwarf custom," he realized.
He waited until it cooled a bit, then doused his face and neck, rubbing them clean as steam swirled off his skin. Rejuvenated, he stripped out of his breeches and tunic and outfitted himself in the clothes he had worn to Arjihad's funeral. He touched Zarok, but decided it would only insult Undin's table, and instead belted on his hunting knife. Then, from his pack, he took the scroll Nasuada had charged him with delivering to Island Zardi, and weighed it in his hand, wondering where to hide it. The missive was too important to leave out in the open where it could be read or stolen. Unable to think of a better place, he slipped the scroll up his sleeve.
"It'll be safe there unless I get into a fight, in which case I'll have bigger problems to worry about."
When at last the servant returned for Aragorn, it was only an hour or so past noon, but the sun had already vanished behind the looming mountains, plunging Tarnag into dusk. Exiting the hall, Aragorn was struck by the city's transformation. With the premature advent of night,
the dwarves' lanterns revealed their true strength, flooding the streets with pure, unwavering light that made the entire valley glow.
Undin and the other dwarves were gathered in the courtyard along with Saphira, who had situated herself at the head of a table. No one appeared interested in disputing her choice.
"Has anything happened?" asked Aragorn, hurrying toward her.
"Undin summoned extra warriors, then had the gates barred."
"Does he expect an attack?"
"At the very least, he's concerned about the possibility."
"Aragorn, please join me,"
said Undin, gesturing at the chair to his right. The clan chief seated himself as Aragorn did, and the rest of the company hurriedly followed suit. Aragorn was happy when Oryk ended up beside him with Arya directly across the table, although both looked grim. Before he could ask Oryk about the ring, Undin slapped the table and roared,
"Igan Ashvoth!"
Servants streamed out of the hall bearing platters of beaten gold, piled high with meats, pies and fruit. They divided into three columns, one for each table, and deposited the dishes with a flourish. Before them were soups and stews filled with various tubers, roasted venison, long hot loaves of sourdough bread, and rows of honey cakes dripped with raspberry preserve. In a bed of greens lay filleted trout garnished with parsley, and on the side pickled eel stared forlornly at an urn of cheese, as if hoping to somehow escape back into a river. A swan sat on each table, surrounded by a flock of stuffed partridges, geese, and ducks. Mushrooms were everywhere, broiled in juicy strips, placed atop a bird's head like a bonnet, or carved in the shape of castles amid moats of gravy. An incredible variety was on display, from puffy white mushrooms the size of Aragorn's fist, to ones he could have mistaken for gnarled bark, to delicate toadstools, sliced neatly in half to showcase their blue flesh. Then the centerpiece of the feast was revealed. A gigantic roasted boar, glistening with sauce. At least Aragorn thought it was a boar, for the carcass was as large as Snowfire and took six dwarves to carry. The tusks were longer than his forearms, the snout wide as his head. And the smell! It overwhelmed all others in pungent waves that made his eyes water from their strength.
"Nogra," whispered Oryk, "giant boar. Undin truly honours you tonight, Aragorn. Only the bravest dwarves dare hunt Nagran, and it is only served to those who have great valour. Also, I think he makes a gesture that he will support you over Durgrimst Nagra."
Aragorn leaned toward him so no one else could hear. "Then this is another animal native to the Beors? What are the rest?"
"Forest wolves, big enough to prey on a Nagra and nimble enough to catch Feldenost. Cave bears, which we call Urjadan, and the elves call Beorn, and for which they dubbed these peaks, though we do not call them such ourselves. The mountain's name is a secret that we share with no race. And..."
"Smervoth,"
commanded Undin, smiling at his guests. The servants immediately drew small curved knives and cut portions of the Nagra, which they set on everyone's plates, except for Arya's, including a weighty piece for Saphira. Undin smiled again, took a dagger, and sliced off a bit of his meat. Aragorn reached for his own knife, but Oryk grabbed his arm.
"Wait."
Undin chewed slowly, rolling his eyes and nodding in an exaggerated fashion, then swallowed and proclaimed,
"Ilf gauneth."
"Now,"
said Oryk, turning to the meal, as conversation erupted along the tables. Aragorn had never tasted anything like the boar. It was juicy, soft, and oddly spicy, as if the meat had been soaked in honey and cider, which was enhanced by the mint used to flavour the pork. "I wonder how they managed to cook something so large."
"Very slowly,"
commented Saphira, nibbling on her Nagra. Between bites, Oryk explained,
"It is custom from days when poisoning was rampant among clans for the host to taste the food first and declare it safe for his guests."
During the banquet, Aragorn divided his time between sampling the multitude of dishes and conversing with Oryk, Arya, and dwarves farther down the table. In that manner the hours hastened by, for the feast was so large it was late afternoon before the last course had been served, the last bite consumed, and the last chalice drained. As servants removed the tableware, Undin turned to Eragon and said,
"The meal pleased you, yes?"
"It was delicious."
Undin nodded.
"I'm glad you enjoyed it. I had the tables moved outside yesterday, so the dragon might dine with us."
He remained intently focused on Eragon all the while he spoke.
Eragon went cold inside. Intentionally or not, Undin had treated Saphira as no more than a beast. Eragon had intended to ask about the veiled dwarves in private, but now, out of a desire to unsettle Undin, he said, "Saphira and I thank you." Then, "Sir, why was the ring thrown at us?" A painful silence crept over the courtyard. Out of the corner of his eye, Eragon saw Oryk wince. Arya, however, smiled, as if she understood what he was doing. Undin put down his dagger, scowling thickly.
"The Nulagan you met are of a tragic clan. Before the Riders' fall, they were among the oldest, richest families of our kingdom. Their doom was sealed, though, by two mistakes. They lived on the western edge of the Beor Mountains, and they volunteered their greatest warriors in Vrail's service."
Anger broke through his voice with sharp cracks.
"Galbatorix and his ever-cursed forsworn slaughtered them in your city of Urubane. Then they flew on us, killing many. Of that clan, only Grimst Kavlors Anuin and her guards survived. Anuin soon died of grief, and her men took the name Ashwelden Rak Anuin, the Tears of Anuin, covering their faces to remind themselves of their loss and their desire for revenge."
Eragon's cheeks stung with shame as he fought to keep his face expressionless.
"So," said Undin, glowering at a pastry, "they rebuilt the clan over the decades, waiting and hunting for recompense. And now you come, bearing Hrothgar's mark. It is the ultimate insult to them, no matter your service in Fardandur. Thus the ring, the ultimate challenge. It means Durgrimst Ashwelden Rak Anuin will oppose you with all their resources, in every matter, big or small. They have set themselves against you utterly, declared themselves blood enemies."
"Do they mean me bodily harm?" asked Eragon stiffly.
Undin's gaze faltered for a moment as he cast a look at Ganel. Then he shook his head and uttered a gruff laugh that was, perhaps, louder than the occasion warranted.
"No, Shadeslayer, not even they would dare hurt a guest. It is forbidden. They only want you gone, gone, gone."
Yet Eragon still wondered. Then Undin said,
"Please, let us talk no more of these unpleasant matters. Ganel and I have offered our food and mead in friendship. Is that not what matters?"
The priest murmured in concordance.
"It is appreciated." Eragon finally relented.
Saphira looked at him with solemn eyes and said,
"They are afraid, Eragon. Afraid and resentful, because they have been forced to accept a rider's assistance."
"Aye, they may fight with us, but they don't fight for us."
Selbadil. The dawnless morning found Eragon in Undin's main hall, listening as the clan chief spoke to Oryk in Dwarvish. Undin broke off as Eragon approached, then said,
"Ah, Shadeslayer, you slept well?"
"Yes."
"Good."
He gestured at Oryk.
"We have been considering your departure. I had hoped you'd be able to spend some time with us, but under the circumstances it seems best if you resume your journey early tomorrow morning, when few are in the streets who might trouble you. Supplies and transportation are being readied even as I speak. It was Hrothgar's orders that guards should accompany you as far as Ceres. I have increased their numbers from 3 to 7.
And in the meantime? Undin shrugged his fur-bound shoulders.
I had intended to show you the wonders of Tarnak, but it would be foolish now for you to wander mine city. However, Grimstborith Ganel has invited you to Selbadil for the day.